How's everyone doing this morning? Good? Good. Okay, so this morning we're going to be talking about Exodus chapter 14, when the Israelites are right about to cross over the Sea of Reeds, or the Red Sea, as is most commonly called. So here in Exodus chapter 14, perfect, thank you. So we will be here with the Israelites, and an important word before we kind of dive into the first verse here, verse 8. In Exodus chapter 14, it talks about the Egyptians a lot. So one of the words that will be helpful as we're thinking about this passage is to unpack Egyptian and what Egyptian literally means in Hebrew. So the word in Hebrew for Egypt or Egyptian, same in Hebrew, is the word Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim. Now, Mitzrayim is kind of a big word, as you can just even hear it. There's a lot of letters and a lot of sounds. Most Hebrew words have a three-letter root. Some have a two or a four or a five-letter root, but most words in Hebrew have a three-letter root. So the root of the word Mitzrayim, which does mean Egypt, is the word tsar. Tsar. Does anyone happen to know what the word tsar in Hebrew literally means? Kind of there, yeah. That's not so far off. Tsar in Hebrew. Anyone happen to know what tsar literally means? Huh? Come on. Narrow. Very good, Chrissy. Narrow. Yes, the word tsar in Hebrew means narrow, so Egypt quite literally in the Hebrew language means the narrow place. Okay, now, why might Egypt be called the narrow place? The Nile River, who said that? Yeah, exactly true. The Nile River, right? All life in ancient Egypt exists along the Nile River. So literally, topographically, it's a narrow place. Now, it's also narrow in another sense, because what are we forced to do down in Egypt? Worship false gods. Thank you, Marie-Claire. We're forced to worship false gods, right? We're forced to worship Pharaoh and the false gods of Egypt. So Egypt is literally topographically narrow all along the Nile River, and it's also spiritually narrow because we're forced to worship false gods. Now, just one puzzle piece here about false gods. There is a kind of an unhelpful understanding of false gods nowadays that false gods will not pay the bills. But I want to suggest, actually, false gods do what? They pay the bills. All the physical bills you got, the false gods will pay them. That's kind of why they're false gods. And if we actually think about life in ancient Egypt of thousands and thousands of years ago, it's actually at this time when the Israelites are here, the greatest civilization on planet Earth. Because if you're living in the desert, part of the world, right? And you're in Egypt. Egypt has the Nile River, meaning we have what? Water. We have water security. And with that water security comes what? Plant life, growth, and you said? Same, and you said? Wealth, exactly. Comes food security, and then job security, right? So water security, food security, job security is nothing to sneeze at in the ancient world. I mean, this is not such a bad place to live. And actually, there's archaeological evidence that at this time, people were breaking into Egypt to become slaves. Because the alternative to being a slave in Egypt was what? Death, right? Dying in the desert. So if my choice is death in the desert or water, food, shelter for my family, might seem kind of like a no-brainer. So this idea that the false gods won't pay all your physical needs, they'll do every one of those things. It's why they're such good at being a false god. So just a little puzzle piece as we think about unpacking these verses here in Exodus chapter 14. So the Egyptians, it says in verse 8, and the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel. And the children of Israel went out with boldness. The Egyptians pursued them. So again, I want to suggest, when it says the Egyptians pursued them, we are talking about the literal people, but we could also understand this to mean what? Louder? Thank you. The narrowness is pursuing them. My narrow place is pursuing me. Okay, looking for two volunteers. If you could raise your hands if you want to volunteer. You don't. Ooh, thank you, Chrissy. Thank you. Okay. A narrow place that has chased you before.
So living here, part of my being here is raising my own support and essentially having people from the States support me to be here. And even up till recently, like, there's just this temptation of, like, I need to figure out my own way to make money, and this isn't a sustainable way of living, and you know, there's just all these doubts and these thoughts and these things that kind of, even though God, I've seen God provide for me to be here, I'm still tempted to be like, well, maybe I should do this or maybe I should do that to kind of, you know, make things work out. But even in my narrow place, God shows up and is just like, hey, I got the bill. I told you I got the bill, so stop worrying about it. So I guess that's kind of a narrow place that I've struggled with in my life.
So for me, I would say it has been my journey with work. So I would have spent hours and hours and hours working, putting all my all into work, and it would consume me completely. It damaged my relationships with friends for a period of time. And it always has that potential to creep up and become more of a priority in my life than what other things are in my life, like friends and family, relationship with our spiritual family. So for me, that's kind of what my narrow place would be.
Thank you. Thank you both. Because I just want to, I think this happens to us actually all the time. And it's not just literally if we have ancient Egyptians chasing us, right, gang? Will I really trust? In those hard moments when it can become very, very easy to stop trusting and to stop having faith, to continue to trust. You know, in those spaces when it would be easy to put work first all the time, and how many people might even say that's really a good thing and that's the right thing, to not prioritize that over God, to not prioritize that over the sacred relationships in my life. Our narrow places are chasing us. They're coming after us. And our narrow places want to do what? They want to... What'd you say? Make us slaves. Bring us back. Right? And as you said, make us slaves, it's the exact right word. So the word that's being used here for slaves and servants that we'll see throughout this passage is the word eved in Hebrew. Eved. And so the Egyptians want to make us slaves again. They want to make us eved. It's just that eved in Hebrew literally means five different things in English. So it literally does mean slave. It also means servant. It also means serve. It also means work. And it also means worship. So this one word in Hebrew will be variantly translated in our Bibles as work, worship, serve, servant, and slave. Work, worship, serve, servant, slave. Meaning, on some level, I might turn my work into what? Worship. I might turn my worship into what? Work. Or maybe even slavery. But I want to suggest I might be the one doing that, right? When I put my work in the place of my worship. To not let that narrow place bring me back to that place of worshiping a false god, to worship Pharaoh. And how it might actually seem like life-giving, right? Because there's water security, there's food security, there's job security. But I want to suggest the false gods pay all the physical bills, but what's still missing? Relationship with God, right? Relationship with God. Because as we even think about it, right, in Exodus chapter 2, before we get to Moses at the burning bush, it says that the Israelites cried out, and their cry reached up to God. Now, I want to suggest if we're crying out, what does that mean? What did you say? Missing something. Exactly. Thank you. We're missing something, right? If I'm crying out to God, it's not necessarily because everything's hunky-dory. It's not because everything's all good. No, I'm crying out to God because there's something wrong. There's something missing, and I know it. And I want to suggest, just as true today, I can be in the industrialized, modern, 21st century world. I have food, I have water, I have a roof, I have family, and yet I might feel like something's missing. And that's really how so much of this gets kicked off for the Israelites. Something is missing. Relationship with God. So here we are in Exodus chapter 14, and we've left Egypt. We're about to cross over the Sea of Reeds, but before we do that, there's something that we all know that if I'm in this passage, in these verses right now, I don't know, which is, what has no one, as far as recorded human history, ever done before? Louder, please. Cross the waters. Gang, no one's ever left Egypt and what? Lived. No people group has ever left the greatest civilization on planet Earth and lived to tell about it. Meaning, we all know that everything is going to be what? Long term. Everything's going to be okay. Everything's going to work. But if I'm the people here right now, what do I not know? Thank you. I don't know the future. I don't know that everything is going to be okay. To actually climb into what it means to be the people in this moment, I don't know necessarily everything that's about to happen. So it says that the people, as the Egyptians are chasing them, and remembering in this moment, we don't exactly know where we are in the sense that we don't know the future. The Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and overtook them, camping by the sea, upon Pi-hahirot before Baal-Zephon. So, Pi-hahirot and Baal-Zephon. Now, these words really tell us actually a quantum information about where we are. So, just a little puzzle piece. When the King James translators decided to translate the Bible into English, they simply transliterated all the names, meaning they just sounded the name out from Hebrew to English. So, Pi-hahirot became Pi-hahirot, right, in my translation. And Baal-Zephon, or Baal-Zephon, as I could translate that, right, in English, became just that, as you see in your translation. Now, these are the names of the places, and the name literally means something. And when I know what the name means, I get told a lot of stuff. This is true also for pretty much all the names throughout our scripture. The names literally mean something. So, let's start with Baal-Zephon, even though it comes second. Baal-Zephon literally means Baal is a false god. So, and Zephon literally means north, but probably more here means hidden. So here we are, and before in Hebrew is the word lifnei, which literally means to the face of. So oftentimes when you see before, it's literally to the face of. So the people are encamped to the face of the false god of the hidden. We're encamped to the face of the false god of the hidden, meaning we are where? What was that? In the wilderness. What was that? False god of the hidden. Sounds kind of what? What'd you say? Mysterious. Mysterious. Oh, good. Okay, mysterious. False god of the hidden, because what can't you see if it's hidden? what kind of God it is, right? And if I'm in Egypt, the God that I worshipped was, or at least one of them, was who? What'd you say? Baal, absolutely. And who's chasing me right now? Pharaoh. I worshipped Pharaoh. And what could I always see when I was down in Egypt? At least sometimes. Pharaoh, meaning on some level I could literally see the God I was worshipping, right? So here we have the false God of the hidden, and the false God of the hidden might look like who? Pharaoh, but it could also look like the real God. Because remember, gang, God is here representing himself as a pillar of cloud. A pillar of cloud. Later on in these verses, meaning I might think that the false God of the hidden is actually God. I might think it's Pharaoh, but I might think it's God. So here we have the false God of the hidden, but there's also Pi-Hahiroth, which is where they're kind of encamped as well, between these two places. Now, Pi-Hahiroth literally means the mouth of freedom. Pi means mouth, and Hahiroth means freedom. So the people are literally encamped. And that word beside or near is actually in Hebrew the word al, which will variantly mean on, upon, about, or over. So imagine, we're literally over the mouth of freedom to the face of the false god of the hidden. Over the mouth of freedom to the face of the false god of the hidden. And I might think that the mouth of freedom is where? Louder, please. The wrong direction, meaning I might think the mouth of freedom is back in Egypt. And I might think the false god of the hidden is this pillar of cloud. Meaning I want to suggest in this moment, we're at really a seminal moment for the people, and we all have a what? A decision. Thank you. A decision. We have a choice here. Am I going to say that the mouth of freedom is God? Or am I going to say that the mouth of freedom is Egypt? And am I going to say the false god of the hidden is maybe a god I've been worshiping for 400 years and can literally see? Or am I going to say it's a pillar of cloud? As we look back on this passage, I think it's a lot easier to say, oh, well, it's so obvious. You know, the false god of the hidden is clearly Egypt, and the mouth of freedom is most obviously the one true God. But to climb into this moment and to think about where we are and how much more deceptive this choice might be for us, how much less clear it actually is in this moment, and how easily I might confuse the two. Pharaoh gets closer, and the Israelites experience what? Fear. We're afraid. Here come the Egyptians. And literally, as the Egyptians draw near, we get afraid, and we say, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? Meaning the people are all saying, what? Let's go back. Let's go back. I don't want to die in the wilderness. I don't know where we're going. Because as they enter into the wilderness, what has God not told them yet? Where they're going. Good. We don't know exactly where we're going. A land flowing with milk and honey. And that is north, south, east, west. That is, good. We don't exactly know where we're going. What else don't we know? How we're going to get there. Good. What else don't we know? How is he going to provide? It's real life. Meaning, if I go anywhere, what do I really want to know? What I'm going to... Thank you. I want to know what I'm going to eat. I want to know all the different kinds of food. I want to know all the different kinds of beverages. I want to know every last detail of what I'm going to eat before I go anywhere, especially on some trip. And we don't know exactly what we're going to eat. Good, good. What else don't we know? Where are we going to sleep? Good. More. There's another huge one. Children say it all the time when driving in a car. When are we going to get there? Are we there yet? How about now? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? If I go anywhere, I want to know how long it's going to take. And God doesn't tell us here how long it's going to take. You know, and actually, the people have a chance to go into the Promised Land, Numbers 13 and 14, roughly 14 to 18 months into their time in the wilderness, and they choose not to go in. Meaning it could be a year and a half-ish, and it ends up being how long? 40 years. I don't know how long it's going to take. Really, the people here know truly what? Do they know a lot of stuff? They know almost nothing about this mission that they're on. They know almost nothing about this journey. And they say, let us go back to Egypt. Did you bring us out here to die in the wilderness? Meaning in this moment, as you talked about earlier, Johann, will I really trust the Lord with all my heart? Because all of these people just witness what back in Egypt? What'd you say? Provision, good. What was that? Security. And you said, Chrissy, the plagues, gang, they just witnessed the 10 plagues. They just witnessed the 10 plagues. And if we think about the 10 plagues, right? These are huge things happening. I mean, we could go through all 10. They're ginormous. And yet the people are saying what? What'd you say? I want to go back. God, you might have done all these things, but am I really going to believe you're going to do something now? You've done so much for me. You've provided for me in so many ways. You've given me and given me and given me. Are you going to do it again? To really trust and have faith at each and every step along the way? When that doubt creeps in, to continue to trust that he'll make my path straight? They just witnessed the 10 plagues. There's a pillar of cloud. And yet, we're still saying, let's go back. Life wasn't so bad. What were we really doing in all here anyway? How easy it is we'll forget what it really was like. And I think this actually happens more often than we think about, too. We talk about a job or a friendship or a relationship, right, that was so, so awful. And then it ends, we start something new, and then we'll talk about, oh, actually, that old job was what? It was actually pretty good. It wasn't so bad. I don't know what I was complaining about for all that time. I mean, if I really think back on it, it wasn't so bad, except for I always what? I always complained. I always cried and moaned. That was just awful. What'd you say? Always worked out Sunday. Right? All the things that I would have said back then, but how often and how quick I'll forget later. To really remember what it was really like when I was really there. And how easily I'll forget those 10 plagues or forget the pillar of cloud that's right here in front of me. But to actually bear a true witness to what was and what is. The people here, are about to do something very important. They're about to do what? Cross over the Sea of Reeds, right? About to cross over the Sea of Reeds. Now, the word crossover in Hebrew, does anyone happen to know what the word Hebrew in the Hebrew language literally means? To cross over. To cross over. Now, does anyone happen to recall the first person who's referred to as being a Hebrew, a crossoverer, in the whole Bible? Anyone happen to remember the first person who's called a Hebrew? What was that? After Noah. Good guess. Before when his name is Abram, exactly. Abram is the first person, Genesis chapter 14, verse 13, who's referred to as being a Hebrew, as being a crossoverer. And at this point in Genesis chapter 14, Abram has crossed over from outside of Canaan to inside of Canaan, from outside of knowing God to inside of knowing the one true God. So Abram has literally crossed over. And crossover in this instance isn't just about his what? What'd you say? Louder. Isn't just about the skin color or where I'm from, but crossing over is actually about identity. Good, identity. And also, amen, and we're going to get into that in one moment. So well said. Identity and about a what that I've made. A decision. A choice to cross over into that relationship with God, very much fundamentally changing my identity. And as we think about this, what it means to cross over, as the people are beginning to leave, in Exodus chapter 12, verse 38, we're told that it's not simply descendants of Jacob that left Egypt. Who else left Egypt? Egyptians. It literally says a mixed multitude, Exodus 12, verse 38, a mixed multitude left Egypt, meaning some descendants of Jacob Israel, but also, as was said up here, some Egyptians and some probably other people groups that were living down in Egypt. And yet after we cross over the Sea of Reeds, does it ever say some Hebrews or Israelites and some other folks from other places left Egypt? No, what does it say? Israelites, Hebrews. Meaning, if I chose to cross over the Red Sea, by definition, I am a what? I'm an Israelite. I'm a Hebrew. I'm a crossover, because I've literally crossed over. Regardless of whether or not my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great, whatever, was an Egyptian, no, if at this moment I cross over, by definition, I'm a crossoverer. And I want to suggest, if I'm a descendant of Jacob and I stay down in Egypt, I'm a what? I'm an Egyptian. I'm a narrow placer. Meaning these words have one degree or dimension that's about my ancestry, who I'm a descendant of, but it's also deeply about the what. What was that? Inheritance? Mm-hmm. Decision relationship, right? The choice that I make, the relationship that I have with God is really also what we're talking about here. And I want to suggest to cross over, if we think about it too, and the Israelites go into the promised land, what are they going to do again? Louder? They're going to cross over into the promised land. Right? They're literally going to cross the Jordan and go into the promised land. Meaning, it's not that I cross over what? Once, and it's over. I actually have to do what? Cross over multiple times. There's multiple crossing overs. Multiple Hebrewings. Because I want to suggest, I could cross over once and might think that I'm all what? It's all good. I crossed over. It's all good. But actually, God wants me to what? Cross over continually and cross over and cross over and cross over. And if we think about Israel too, Israel in Hebrew, we learn this in Genesis chapter 32, literally means one who wrestles with God and with people and is able. one who wrestles with God and with people and is able. Genesis chapter 32, the meaning of Israel. Meaning I want to suggest these are things that don't really what? They don't really stop. Thank you, Chrissy. They don't really stop. I keep crossing over. I keep wrestling with God and with people, and I'm able. And I want to suggest the people get into trouble when? When they stop crossing over, when they stop wrestling with God and with people and are able. It's a continual thing. It's not, there is usually a big moment, but then there's also a lot of little moments that follow, or maybe seemingly little moments, not quite so little. It's weekly or daily or monthly or moment by moment by moment. And here, the people are really considering what? Not crossing over. Not crossing over. And as Troy kind of pointed to, not crossing over into that identity in God of staying, but actually even more going back to where we've been. Moses has a very, very, very fun reply here. Moses says, Moses says to the people, have no fear. Stand by and witness the salvation of the Lord, which the Lord will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will battle for you. You stay quiet. Meaning, Moses is saying to do what? What'd you say? Don't do anything, be still. Because for most of the 10 plagues, what did we have to do? Nothing, right? For most of the 10 plagues, outside of the 10th, we don't really have to do anything, right? This is not really our bag. This is whose deal? God. God takes care of all this stuff. And Moses is saying, again, God is going to do what? God's going to take care of it. What'd you say, Caleb? Great. Well, yes. And this is where we'll be on Saturday talking about grace. Right? God's going to take care of it. You don't have to do a thing. Just stand by. Witness the deliverance. Witness the salvation of the Lord. Now, Moses says this to the people, but God says something more than tiny bit different, right? What God says is, this is verse 15, then the Lord said to Moses, why do you cry out to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward. And lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. Okay, meaning, Moses is saying, stand by, witness the salvation of the Lord. And God's saying what? What'd you say? He's telling Moses to do it and go forward. Meaning, I want to suggest this looks a little bit different than it often gets portrayed. Okay, for a quick demonstration of what we're talking about here, I need six volunteers to stand up for a little demonstration. Oh, perfect. Okay. Lewis? Would you come up? Thank you. Okay, perfect. Okay, if you all could come here. Okay, Lewis, could you stand here? Okay, now all of you, if you could stand like this way. Yeah, kind of in a line. Okay, close to each other. And then maybe one person there. Yeah, perfect. Okay, and then Lewis, if you could stand and turn around facing everyone. Okay, so I want to suggest Lewis here is representing Moses and the Israelites. Okay? Really representing the Israelites. So here are the Israelites, and here we have the sea. So the five of you represent the sea. Now Moses says, stand by, witness the salvation of the Lord. But what God says is, why do you cry out to me? Go forward. Meaning, God's asking the people to go forward when? Now. And I want to suggest before what? Before the seas part. God's not saying, walk towards the waters once Moses parts them. He's saying, walk towards the waters before they are parted. Meaning, imagine the sea. It's literally right before you. And here we have the people. And so you need to do what? You need to go forward exactly before the waters part. Meaning, I want to suggest God's asking the people to do what? Trust, have faith. To really trust and have faith, to walk towards the unparted, the waters before they're parted. Thank you, guys. Oh, there I am again. Sorry. I want to suggest most folks, I'll just speak for myself personally, I want to walk towards the waters when? After they part. Thank you very much. I don't particularly want to walk towards the water when? When it's a normal ocean. God, I'm all good. If you want to part those waters, I'll start walking. I'm great. I'm all in. Got it. To walk towards the waters before he parts them. Trust, faith, as we talked about this morning, to keep our path straight. To really trust and have faith in that moment. Because unlike the 10 plagues, this is a time when what? I'm being affected, good, and I have to trust. And I have to take the first step here. This isn't just a stand by and witness. I have an active role to play. I have an active thing I have to do. And if we think about it, we're really looking at a gigantic moment of what from the Israelites in going from Egypt to the wilderness. Faith, good. What'd you say? Obedience, absolutely. Grace, favor, good. Every single word. And this is a huge moment of what for them? What'd you say? Exercising their faith, absolutely. Freedom, choice, amen. Change of heart. Okay, and I'll take that too. Transition. Right? This is a huge moment of transition from what it means to be a slave in Egypt, what it means to have a heart of a slave in Egypt, what it means to have the faith of a slave in Egypt, to now having freedom and choice and grace and in the wilderness. This is a huge moment of transition. And in this huge moment of transition, things, as we kind of said earlier, all the things we don't know, there's tremendous what in this moment of transition. Fear, good. Fear and uncertainty, right? There's an immense amount of fear and uncertainty in this moment of transition. And as we began in this passage, our narrow places are chasing after us. There's fear, there's uncertainty. I don't know what tomorrow brings. I don't know what today brings. And our narrow places are coming after us. And in this moment, will I really trust? Will I really have faith? Will I really let go of needing to know every last detail? And will I continue to walk with God?